today. As the government continues to withhold the Russia report, the author of a new book about Russian espionage explores how spies have sought to undermine British democracy. For years, Guardian senior international correspondent Luke Harding has written about Vladimir Putin's Russia and made it his business to understand Russian involvement in the upper echelons of British life.
At the end of last year, there was a very exclusive party which took place in a wonderful white stuccoed mansion overlooking Regent's Park in the centre of London. And the host was Alexander Lebedev. It was his 60th birthday, a media tycoon, owner of the Evening Standard, run by his son, Yevgeny. And also, he's a former KGB agent who worked in London in the 1980s, at a time when the Soviet regime was trying to bring down capitalism. And he was a spy, a rather superior foreign spy. Now, these parties have been going on for a while. They are characterized by vodka, champagne, and really more famous people than you can kind of fit in a London kitchen. So Bob Geldof was there, Mick Jagger was there, Princess Eugenie, Queen's granddaughter, was there.
Wow.
And a smattering of very high-profile politicians. I think probably that the starriest guest of all was someone called Boris Johnson, arriving with a much younger woman who was his girlfriend, now fiancée, Carrie Simmons. And I think what's striking about this was the timing. This was the day after the general election in the UK where Johnson had won an 80-odd majority, smashed the Labour Party and Jeremy Corbyn. But also, I think we can only interpret the fact that he decides to go to this party as a V-sign to his critics over Russia, because one of the big scandals of the election campaign was that the Russia report, drawn up by Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee over 2 years, was ready for publication in October of 2019. And Johnson refused to publish it before the election, when actually you would think the voters would like to know what Russia was doing in terms of trying to influence British and Western electoral politics. And also with kind of unresolved questions about just what the Kremlin did to help Brexit, Johnson's pet project, and so on. So this was an astonishing thing for Boris Johnson to do, and I suspect it caused much rejoicing in Moscow.
Months on from that opulent night in London, the report into alleged Russian interference in British politics has still not been published. Luke can't be certain as to what the findings of the report might be, but he does have exclusive access to the testimony of one key witness, which makes explosive allegations about British politicians ignoring possible Russian interference in the 2016 Brexit referendum. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, why it's time for the UK government to release the Russia report. The Russia report, which set out to investigate alleged Russian interference in British politics, was completed last year, but it still hasn't been published. Initially, this was because Boris Johnson refused to release it in the run-up to the election. And since that election, it still hasn't come out, because the relevant committee has not been cleared yet to reconvene. That committee is Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee, whose job it is to oversee the work of the UK's spy agencies. And they gathered evidence between 2017 and 2018 from a series of witnesses. Who did they hear from?
Some secret people have been giving evidence. We don't know what their names are. We don't know what they look like. We don't know where they met with the committee, but they will be senior people inside MI6, MI5, possibly GCHQ as well, whose day-to-day job is counterintelligence and countering Russian interference, if you like, in this country. There've been kind of external witnesses who know a thing or two about Russia. One of them was Bill Browder, a former businessman and investor in Russia who clashed with the Putin regime after his lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, died in prison in pretty grim circumstances, a couple of journalists, and also a former spy, rather a famous one, who spent 22 years working for British intelligence before going into private business, by the name of Christopher Steele.
It is so rare for a spy to be named publicly, even more so for his work to be published. Christopher Steele is reported to have left his home yesterday, leaving his three cats with a neighbor.
Tonight, the former spy at the center of the storm, now in hiding, and this evening here, new video of him.
This impeccably dressed 52-year-old man in a video posted by a British debate society, Christopher Steele.
I think Christopher Steele is probably the most famous British spy since James Bond, and he has the advantage of being real. I've met him on several occasions.
Infinitely better then in that case.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't look much like James Bond. I mean, he like all good spies or ex-spies, he's rather inconspicuous, smartly dressed, good at eye contact, medium height, now in his mid-50s. And he was recruited from Cambridge University, trained to speak Russian in the late 1980s, and posted as a junior spy to the Soviet Union in April of 1990 at a time of kind of rapid change.
Tanks were also positioned outside the Russian Parliament building, Boris Yeltsin's headquarters.
Yeltsin! Yeltsin! Yeltsin!
The democratically elected president of Russia was soon striding out of the building to address a crowd of supporters. His own radio and television stations by now occupied and forced off the air, he climbed aboard one of the Red Army's own tanks and said the coup leaders had disgraced the Soviet Union.
He watched Boris Yeltsin climb on that tank. You'll remember that when there was a KGB coup in the summer of 91. Chris Steele was there reporting back on what was going on. And he spent 3 years in Moscow and basically was involved in one way or another throughout the rest of his MI6 career in Russian affairs. So he's someone familiar with the KGB and its successor agency, the FSB. And in 2006, when Litvinenko was poisoned with radioactive polonium, Steele was chosen by MI6 to kind of head up the inquiry into what had happened. And pretty quickly, he concluded that the Russian state had decided to wipe out someone in grisly, exotic fashion.
On the 1st of November 2006, former Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko left his home in Muswell Hill in London and travelled to the Millennium Hotel in the centre of the city. There, he met two former KGB agents, Andrei Lugovoy and Dmitry Kovtun. They had a pot of tea waiting for him. He drank only a small amount during their 20-minute meeting. Within hours, he felt ill. Within days, he was in hospital. He died in intensive care 22 days later of radiation poisoning.
And of course, he's most famous or notorious, depending on your perspective, for his report in 2016 into Donald Trump and Russia, which he wrote for Hillary Clinton's Democrats, and which alleged, many things, but two things in particular. One, that the Kremlin had been cultivating Donald Trump for a long period of time, at least 5 years. And two, that the Russian spy agencies had a kind of huge vault of compromising material known as compromat on Trump, who made many trips to Russia, including video footage taken in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in 2013 when Trump was in town for the Miss Universe beauty pageant. And Trump was, he denies this, but allegedly cavorting with two prostitutes. Trump has denounced Steele as a failed spy, as a lowlife, as a kind of British hoodlum.
And they paid for a fake dossier. They gave money to foreigners to write a fake dossier, totally disproven, totally fake. The FBI then took that fake dossier and they used it in the FISA court to get approval to spy on my campaign.
And there's a constant stream of insults from Donald Trump. We had the Mueller report, which corroborated some of the dossier, but not all of it, certainly corroborated the influence operations side.
So this is someone who has had a very long and high-profile espionage career with a lot of focus on Russia. It's not difficult to see why Christopher Steele was asked to give evidence to the Intelligence and Security Committee. But you got exclusive access to that evidence. How did you manage to get that?
Well, I can't divulge that information, but I've seen some of it. I haven't seen all of it, but the document I've seen is a 7-page memo written by Christopher Steele in August of 2018. It's a sort of strategic overview of Russian operations in the UK, and almost a kind of wake-up call, I would say, to government that they need to do more to combat the threat of Russian interference. And say what you like about Chris Steele, it's a formidable document. It's a very good piece of analysis.
But as well as being a wider critique of British policy towards Russia over the decades, his evidence also makes two quite specific allegations. And the first of these relates to that 2016 dossier you've just mentioned that Steele compiled about Donald Trump. Tell me more about that first allegation.
So I think the most damning allegation from Christopher Steele's evidence is essentially that the government, the then government of Theresa May, who was prime minister, and Boris Johnson as foreign secretary, were basically warned in pretty explicit terms that it was possible that the Kremlin had leverage over Donald Trump, a likely hold over the incoming president of the United States. And in normal circumstances, if you are the government and you come across an allegation this serious, you would probably investigate it. Of course, you know, if Donald Trump is compromised by the Russians, that has enormous implications for intelligence sharing, for Britain's own security, and so on. But according to Steele, May and Johnson threw a blanket over this at the end of 2016 when they saw Steele's dossier, because they were terrified about offending Donald Trump, worried what he might say if he felt the perfidious Brits were investigating him in any way vis-a-vis Russia. And it was never kind of properly examined by the British state. Now, MI6 has a permanent counterintelligence mandate. It's supposed to look at threats all of the time. But my understanding is that if you come into possession of something very damaging about an allied foreign leader, to kind of go down that road to investigate further, to use your secret sources in Moscow, for example, you would need tasking, you would need permission from the government and the foreign secretary of the day, Boris Johnson, who's in charge of MI6. And that permission never came.
So do you think it's credible that the Russians would be trying to find compromising material on Donald Trump?
Of course. Of course. I haven't talked to anybody who actually knows Russia, either Russians or career professionals who've been involved there, who doesn't think that the Russians have got compromising material on Donald Trump. I mean, it's how they roll. When I was there in Moscow as the Guardian's correspondent for 4 years, we had repeated break-ins at our family apartment by the FSB, Putin's spy agency.
Wow.
And I took advice from the British Embassy in Moscow. And I said, what's going on? And they said, yeah, it's the FSB. And I said, am I bugged? Are we bugged? And they said, yeah, you are. And I said, well, what about the bedroom? And they said, yeah, the bedroom as well. And I said, look, is there anything Her Majesty's government could do about this? And they said, you know, no, have a biscuit, basically, which is the kind of British Embassy way. But the substantial point is that if the FSB will break into my apartment and bug me as a kind of irksome foreign correspondent, of course they will bug and have technical equipment in the presidential suite of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, used by President Obama, used by Donald Trump, and so on. It's what they do.
Wow, okay. That is quite a story. What else does Steele allege in his evidence?
As well as the allegation that the Russians most probably or likely have a hold over Donald Trump, Steele makes a second allegation, and that is that there are indications, as he puts it, that the Russians interfered in the 2016 EU referendum, and also may have been behind clandestine funding of it. In other words, covertly funneled money to pro-Brexit sort of parties, campaigners, movements, and so on. That is the claim.
And again, crucially, that this wasn't looked into properly at the time.
So Steele says that May and Johnson threw a blanket over these allegations, that essentially the spooks, the spies, MI6 took this very seriously and did their job professionally and calmly. But the politicians, for political reasons, because if the Brexit referendum was a cheat, then clearly it's much harder to argue that this is the for all times fixed will of the people to have Brexit. I mean, if it's also the will of Vladimir Putin, then that somewhat undermines the kind of Brexit case. So the point is, they could have investigated both of these allegations, but per Steele, they didn't.
You've dedicated a chapter of your book to this, Luke, and have written about it for quite some time. What have you concluded?
Well, I mean, I've concluded that as a minimum, the Russians carried out a kind of extensive espionage operation in support of Brexit, comparable with, if not on the same scale as, the operation to help elect Donald Trump in America in 2016. These were twin operations, Brexit-Trump, Trump-Brexit, often involving the same spies, the same trolls, by the way. There was a huge troll, Russian troll campaign in support of Brexit run out of St. Petersburg. And the big picture is that Putin is not an evil supervillain sitting on a leather chair, flashing little red buttons on a console and making things happen all over the world. He is a classic KGB opportunist who sniffs out weakness and division in Western societies and tries to exploit that to his own advantage and to sort of for Russian sovereign purposes. And the point about the Trump vote and the Brexit vote is they were both incredibly close, actually. And in that kind of environment where Russian spies are pushing, and trolls are tweeting, and money may or may not be flowing, that can be quite decisive. Certainly Moscow sees Trump's election as its triumph, and I think also is pretty pleased with Brexit and feels that it's co-contributed to the Brexit vote as well, even if it wasn't the only reason. I'm not saying that. But one clue we have to that is that Alexander Yakovenko, the ambassador, left in summer of last year, left London, effectively saying, mission accomplished. And he told one fellow diplomat, I quote this in my book, we have crushed the British to the ground. They are on their knees and they will not rise for a very long time. That's the view from Moscow.
So you have these two allegations at the heart of Christopher Steele's evidence, one about Trump and the other about Brexit, and that successive British prime ministers have thrown a blanket, as you say, over them. What does he suspect is really going on here?
I think Christopher Steele suspects that faced with the difficult decision to investigate Trump and interrogate what happened in 2016 around Brexit, that Theresa May and Boris Johnson buried their kind of concerns or the concerns of the security agencies for political reasons. Ultimately, because the end destination for them was a trade deal, a US-UK trade deal that would make Brexit work, that would make this political project look like a success rather than a failure. And so politics came before national security. That is a really serious charge to make against the sitting Prime Minister and Foreign Secretary.
After this, Christopher Steele reveals the ways Vladimir Putin has sought to undermine Western democracy. But first, I want to take you behind the scenes for a second.
Yeah. You know what? Can I take the duvet off my head? I'm like, it's like 45 degrees in my...
Yeah, sure. Because making this podcast during lockdown hasn't always been easy. And Luke Harding isn't the only Guardian journalist who's overheated while trying to record an interview with us. In fact, for the past few months, Anushka has been broadcasting from under her kid's blanket, and I've been doing all of my interviews from a three-man tent in my bedroom. So if you've been enjoying our episodes, please vote for us in the Listener's Choice category at the British Podcast Awards by going to britishpodcastawards.com/vote. Do so not just for the brilliant journalism and amazing stories that you hear on Today in Focus, but because the people that bring them to you have literally gone undercover to do so. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm in sauna mode. Okay, I'm pressing record, so I'm good to go.
Okay, so you're back in sauna mode. Fantastic.
Christopher Steele is written evidence. He frames these examples as being part of a bigger story about Russia and the West, which is one you know very well. Essentially, he's arguing that Russia under Putin has become a very powerful rogue state. How does he argue that Russia has done this?
So Steele argues that Russia has become emboldened under Vladimir Putin, largely because the West has not responded to acts of aggression, political subversion that the Kremlin has carried out in recent years. And he talks about paradigm shifts, six paradigm shift moments where the Kremlin has done something atrocious and the response from the UK or other countries has been conventional, a few diplomats kicked out, rather than something more sort of serious. And the first one he cites is the breakup of the Yukos oil company.
Yukos was once Russia's biggest oil firm. Now a European court says the Russian government violated its rights and forced it into bankruptcy.
And this was a sign, really, that the Russian state could seize private assets if it wanted, and there was nothing anyone could do about it. The second is the murder by radioactive tea of Alexander Litvinenko in 2006.
The inquiry heard that as he lay on his deathbed, he told them he'd been targeted by the Russian Secret Service on the personal orders of Vladimir Putin.
The trail of polonium traces leads not just from London to Moscow, but directly to the door of Vladimir Putin's office.
The third is the invasion by Russian troops of Georgia, neighbouring state.
Buildings are burning from the last airstrike, and people are warning that the Russian Air Force may soon be back. There's absolutely nothing that the Georgian forces can do to stop these attacks. The Russian Air Force has complete command of the air, and already you can sense that ordinary Georgian people are beginning to feel helpless.
The fourth is the annexation of Crimea in 2014 by Russia and the war in eastern Ukraine.
Russia's parliament has given its approval for military forces to invade Ukraine after President Putin declared Russian citizens in Crimea were at risk.
The fifth is the poisoning of Sergei and Yulia Skripal.
The BBC understands that a Russian man who was convicted in his homeland of spying for Britain is critically ill in hospital in Wiltshire, along with a woman, after they were exposed to an unknown substance. Police were called to a shopping centre in Salisbury yesterday, where the couple fell ill.
And the sixth is interfering in Western elections.
Our investigation found that the Russian government interfered in our election in sweeping and systematic fashion.
And so there's the kind of pattern here. What Steele says is that Putin does these things, waits for a response. When it doesn't happen, he doubles down.
Two of the points on that list, Luke, the murder of Alexander Litvinenko and the Salisbury poisonings, happened on UK soil. And when Steele talks about interference in Western elections, he's not just referring to the US, but also to the UK, and in particular, the Brexit referendum. Why does Putin appear to take such an interest in this country?
I think Putin has a particular obsession with Britain. He really loathes this place. There is a large, influential emigre community here, made up to some degree of people who are loyal to the regime and who just like living in London and have their mistresses here or their families here and so on, but also of dissidents and critics and people who write unflattering things about him. And he feels that the UK basically betrayed him. For example, back in the Tony Blair years, he wanted Tony Blair to send back for trial Boris Berezovsky, Putin's one-time friend, turned arch critic. And Blair didn't do that. And just explained, look, Vladimir, I can't phone up a judge and tell him what to do. The judicial system in this country is independent. And Vladimir genuinely didn't believe Blair. He thought that if Blair were a better friend, he would have picked up the phone and told the judge what to do, like in Russia. And so he feels that the UK is a haven of trouble. Also, the other thing is, there is a love element as well. It's kind of love-hate, because wealthy Russians put their money in London. They store it with Western banks. They store it through offshore structures set up by accountants in the city.
All of this forms part of the evidence that Christopher Steele gave to the Intelligence and Security Committee 2 years ago for this report, which still hasn't been published. Why not? Why has it taken so long for this to be released?
The conspiratorial view, which I have to say I share to some extent, is that there's something in it which Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings don't like. very much. I don't think there is an explosive moment where we will all kind of fall over and say, oh my God, Boris Johnson is a Russian agent, for example. But I think what there is probably a fairly kind of nuanced discussion of how Russia has tried to influence British politics in recent years. But I think essentially the problem here is Brexit and Tory party funding. Really, I don't think Johnson wants anything out there which casts doubt on the legitimacy of the 2016 referendum. And so he has suppressed the report because he can suppress it. It'd be very interesting to see, you know, when it does come out, what's in it, first of all, but also the secret annex. And by the way, if anyone gets the secret annex who's listening to this podcast and they can leak it to me, I will be terrifically grateful. Put it in a brown envelope. Don't send it electronically. And send it to the Guardian offices, please.
That would be one of our greatest listener interactions ever, I think. Always. I think you've used us for leak requests before, I've just been told. As you say, it is possible that when the report does come out, it might not be as explosive as some might be hoping. So why should we care about whether it comes out or not?
I think we should care because we are a democracy. I mean, actually, what makes the UK different from countries like Russia or other kind of authoritarian regimes in the post-Soviet Union is that there is kind of accountability, that we have governments that change, for example. We have politicians that come in and come out. This week, of course, Putin is holding a constitutional vote in Russia, which he's going to win. And that gives him the ability to stay in power until 2036. I can scarcely say it, but that means he'll out Stalin, out Brezhnev, and effectively it kind of formalizes what as everyone knows is a dictatorship. Really, wherever you stand on the Brexit conversation, whether you're a fan of Boris Johnson, I think he's wonderful and honest and truthful and all the rest of it. It doesn't really matter. It's about the integrity of British democracy. It's about asking what precisely did the Russians do in 2016 in London, but also, I guess, in Washington as well, because they haven't stopped. This isn't history. This is present. This is happening now. And basically, the world, from Vladimir Putin's perspective, is going in the right geopolitical direction. I mean, the West is in turmoil. The moderate centre is in trouble. Britain is leaving the European Union. It's all going his way. And really, we need to find out what Russia played in 2016, even if it's to discount it. But unless you interrogate that period, you don't know how to guard against future attacks.
Luke, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Luke Harding. His new book, Shadow State: Murder, Mayhem, and Russia's Remaking of the West, is available to buy now from the Guardian Bookshop. Just go to guardianbookshop.com. Today's episode was produced by Joshua Kelly and sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.